LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and I'm delighted to report that this program has been cleared for broadcast by the Pyongyang Cultural Police. My guest today is Stephen Hurl, who joins us to discuss his book, Dinosaurs and the Expanding Earth. When the book was first published, it proposed a startling idea to explain the long-standing puzzle of the dinosaurs' vast size. Some paleontologists have suggested that many dinosaurs' bones were simply not strong enough to support their enormous weight. Hurl, however, presents scientific evidence that dinosaurs lived in reduced gravity, and this allowed them to grow to gigantic proportions. The reduced gravity Earth theory explains why life, including dinosaurs, plants, and insects, evolved towards a larger scale on the ancient Earth. It's also a key piece of evidence that provides additional support for an expanding Earth, something a number of leading geologists have been suggesting for decades. Expanding Earth theory postulates that hundreds of millions of years ago, our planet was much, much smaller, gradually growing over time as it accrued material from elsewhere in the solar system. For reasons still debated, the dinosaurs, and indeed many other ancient forms of life, did not survive the Earth changes that beset them. If such changes are in fact not in the distant past, but actually still underway, what could this mean for the future of life on Earth? And as changing gravity and expanding Earth claim to answer some of the most vexing questions about life on our planet, what might they suggest about life elsewhere in the solar system, the galaxy, and the entire universe? Hello and welcome, Stephen, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello, Greg. It's nice to be here.
Today, Stephen, we're going to be talking about your book, Dinosaurs and the Expanding Earth. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in the topics that are included in the book.
Well, I'm a mechanical engineering designer, so I'm well used to designing structures. And I started thinking about that in way back in 1987. And I realized that the mechanical principles that I was looking at were exactly the same for dinosaurs. And from that, I then took that to its logical conclusion, which was that actually the gravity of the Earth had to be less to allow the dinosaurs to grow so large.
The title of your book, Dinosaurs and the Expanding Earth. Now, I refer listeners back to last week's show, which was all about expanding Earth theory, which I did with James Maxlow. Basically, the idea is here that in the distant past, the Earth was actually smaller. So just give us your take on that briefly, and just why that would affect the gravity. And then just, you're talking about how the dinosaurs could be bigger, life in the past could be larger, how that relates to gravity.
I mean, most people come at it from the geological evidence for an expanding Earth, but I actually started the other way around, and my first thoughts were about dinosaurs, whether they could exist in present gravity or not. And from this, I concluded that they could be as large as they were in a reduced gravity. And from that, it then follows on. I started thinking, well, how could gravity possibly be less? If we look out to Mars, the Moon and Venus, obviously gravity is less on there. But the reason it's less is because they're smaller. So my thoughts were that actually gravity should be less on a smaller planet. And then when I started researching into this, I found all this evidence that had been presented by various geologists over time, indicating that the Earth was smaller. So it's on a smaller diameter planet, gravity is less. So it all tied in quite neatly with what I was thinking about dinosaurs. I've come at it in a different direction than most people, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I think James, say, who was on last week, he very much started as a geologist thinking about the history of the Earth itself. So what was this just a brainwave for you about dinosaurs, or were you perhaps a bit like me? You know, perhaps as a boy you were fascinated with dinosaurs, as a lot of boys of our generation seem to have been, and it's something, an interest that never really left you. Was that the case with you?
No, I don't think it was that. It was more that my job at the time, I was working in the Electricity Council Research Centre, and my job was to, we were taking small units and then trying to enlarge them for the industrial process. And part of the problem when you do that, you have problems with scale effects, in that as things get larger, the volume increases faster than the area. So this puts more stress on the units at a larger scale. And I just took that to its logical conclusion and started thinking about dinosaurs, and realized that actually that was exactly the same problem with dinosaurs, that they were actually too big for our present gravity.
So in terms of gravitational effects, just in, you know, as it is in the world that we live in, and there was a diagram in your book showing a bridge that had collapsed under its own weight, as it were. I mean, presumably something like that could have sustained itself if gravity was less on the Earth. And from an engineering point of view, what are the factors that affect the size of, using your engineering background, the size of a structure? I mean, my thinking is, not knowing anything about it, is that you can build anything as big as you want, as long as you build it correctly, appropriately, and it's got strength in the right places. I mean, are there any limits? And even if there aren't, if there are no limits, if something's constructed correctly and designed correctly, what are the factors that cause problems with man-made structures?
No, there's definitely limits to any structures. If we just consider a very simple shape, so say a cube, and then assume that we have that same cube and make it twice as big, then the volume is actually eight times more, but the area is only four times as big for something that's twice as big on linear size. And if we actually plot the two we could actually plot the volume, and hence the mass increases faster than the surface area. So this means as something gets larger, there's more and more stress imposed on any structure. So there's a definite limit to whatever structure we have. There's a limit to how big we can build a bridge, for instance, just because the weight increases, the relative weight increases faster than the actual strength of the material as it gets bigger. This really imposes, this whole thing imposes an upper boundary to the scale of any structure. So we can take that same idea, and then you could consider two animals of exactly the same shape, with one animal twice as large as the other. And then as this animal becomes larger, its mass and hence its weight varies in relation to the length cubed, while its area only increases in relation to its unit length squared. And so the larger animal would have double the leg stress due to the scale effect. And this then is what imposes limits on all life. So we can see that in nature. If you just look at a squirrel can bound around quite easily because it's at a small scale. But as we increase up larger in an animal, we can actually see that an elephant has actually reached the limit to what sort of a limit to the size of an animal in today's gravity. You can actually see that in nature.
Of course, people might say something like, what about a blue whale? But that's quite different because it's in water.
That's right. A blue whale's, because of the buoyancy effect of the water, it's holding up at that mass. And in fact, a blue whale is quite interesting because it effectively doesn't see any effect of gravity. It can actually grow larger. And this is the reason that a blue whale can, of course, grow as large as it can. A blue whale is really showing us that if gravity was less, animals could grow large. They're quite interesting to look at those.
This does make sense to me in terms of, you know, weight crushing internal organs and things if a creature got too big. I hadn't considered that it could apply to artificial structures.
No. Yeah, it does apply to. I mean, this is why engineers are so happy when they keep saying we have now built the largest building in the world, because, of course, if buildings get larger and larger, it becomes more and more difficult to actually engineer them at that scale. You know, you've got to use all sorts of tricks to actually get something to be really, really big.
So at some point with all these huge towers that we see, well, actually not that many of them, but, you know, as you say, every few years, somebody else, whether it's, you know, in Dubai or where, I can't remember exactly where that huge tower was, and then maybe somebody in China will announce that they're going to do such and such. It's going to be slightly bigger. They're going to put a pole on top of it and cheat a little bit to make it taller. At some point, that's going to stop. There will be some limit to human hubris when it comes to buildings.
That's right. Yes, there's always got to be a limit to how big things can be. And this is really why, if we go back through history, I think the pyramids were the biggest thing until there was somewhere, wasn't there a cathedral somewhere in England that was slightly larger than the pyramids? And then the Eiffel Tower was built. When the Eiffel Tower was built, that used all new material. And because we had the cast iron now that could be used, the Eiffel Tower could be built even higher. And now in modern day buildings, they're introducing all new material all the time, which is actually enable them to build higher and higher and taller buildings.
As we begin to work our way up to talking about the dinosaurs as such, I'll just rewind a little bit, dip into a couple of issues that you deal with in the book with relating to the expanding Earth. And I don't know if you've seen any of the work that the biologist Rupert Sheldrake has done. It's more of a spin-off from his work as opposed to the main focus. But he speculated that some of the so-called constants that are supposed to never vary, such as gravity and even the speed of light, he speculated that they do actually show, it's just not talked about, but they do actually show small variations over time, but they just normalize it and correct it and just say no more about it. But that opens the door to the idea that, if we forget the speed of light for now because that's not relevant and quite controversial, but the idea that we can see that gravity varies on different, you know, planetary bodies, but the very idea that gravity as measured on the Earth right now might show slight variations is in itself quite interesting, I think.
Yes, it is. And the universal constant of gravity it's been postulated that has varied slightly as well, hasn't it? So it's one of those things we have to assume they are constant, but nobody was around measuring them a couple of hundred years ago. So they might well vary over time.
A couple of hundred years ago and a couple of thousand years ago and so on back in time.
Yes, thousands of years ago. That obviously we can only assume that they're not varying.
One of the things that arises in people's minds when you first put to them the expanding Earth theory is this idea, okay, so you're saying that the Earth started out much smaller than it is now and it is constantly expanding. Where does the new matter come from? And in your book, you go through basically three scenarios to try and account for this.
In fact, there's actually quite a few more than three. I think there's at least half a dozen now that I think in the last few years people have started looking at it in a bit more detail and realised that there are quite a few different means that it might well be expanding. But as you say, I'd only gone through some very basic ones there in my book. There was just some sort of mass increase where gravitation was actually ether was being pulled into the Earth, and that was producing a mass increase. The third one was all the cosmic bombardment by cosmic dust coming in and covering the Earth every 100,000 years or so.
Of course, ether is a name that was used by scientists in the past, and which that's kind of been refined since then.
That's right. I mean, ether, really, to me, they're really talking about space-time, aren't they? And wondering if in some way this could actually get pulled into the Earth and then wrapped up. And once it's wrapped up in a confined space, does it then produce a mass within the Earth? Hildenberg actually did quite a bit of work on this. And I mean, as you say, he called it ether at the time, but we wouldn't call it that nowadays. But it's concepts. It's interesting in that when you start thinking about gravity and what exactly is gravity, his concept was that actually space-time was being pulled into the Earth. And because we were effectively being moved, we were not being accelerated through space. Space was being accelerated past us. This is actually what produces gravity. So there's always been this idea that, I mean, you're obviously aware that if we're in outer space and then we start to accelerate, we will feel the force of gravity. So that's what he's saying. He's saying that he's inverted that idea, really, and assumed that space is actually being pulled past us to produce gravity. So we're actually accelerating past space. What he's really saying is, if we just assume we're in outer space somewhere, and then we're accelerated in outer space, we will feel the effect of that acceleration, and we won't be able to know the difference between that acceleration and the effect of gravity on us, because we're being accelerated through space. He's then taking that idea of, okay, we're not in space anymore, we're standing on the surface of the Earth. And if space was now being pulled into the Earth and being accelerated past us as it goes into the Earth, then we would actually feel the force of gravity. So it's actually an acceleration of space going into the Earth.
Going back again in time, looking at a couple of bits of evidence that suggest or that back up an expanding Earth theory, one that you cite in the book is the very early reptiles that came, that preceded the dinosaurs. And not only these species, in fact, earlier forms of life, but in particular these reptiles, which were, you know, unlike some of the early forms of life, they were very mobile and getting around all over the place. These fossils have been found all over the world and in places that are now completely separate and isolated from each other. And this wouldn't work with the idea of Pangaea, which we mentioned last week, this original one supercontinent on the early Earth. If that existed on the Earth in the size it is now, surrounded by this super ocean, then basically that wouldn't work. The fossils wouldn't be found in the way that they are now. Basically, so it suggests that the early Earth was like it is in the expanding Earth theory. Basically, it's like one crust and then, you know, over time developed some seas. But basically, it was one landmass, but on a much smaller Earth with no super ocean, just little pockets of water.
Yes, that's right. I mean, basically, when the continents were reconstructed, you have to actually leave a gap in all the continents, because at some point, whichever way you put them all together, at some point on the Earth of today's diameter, there has to be a gap, more or less like a cut of a pie. If you imagine a pie, has to be cut out. And the only way to reduce that gap is to assume that it's actually reconstructed on a smaller diameter Earth. So today's constructions on today's same diameter leave this gap, and of course this gap causes a problem, because there's one called the Tethys Ocean, and this is postulated as being an ancient sea that was as big as the Atlantic, but on either side of that sea we can actually see the same animals and plants. And I mean when I've been chatting to Dr. Hugh Owen, who used to work at the Natural History Museum, he was telling me that obviously this caused quite a bit of argument between himself and other people, because you have to explain somehow how did those animals and plants, how did they appear on both sides of the this large ocean at the same time. You know, whereas on a, if you actually assume that we are looking at what it looks like we're looking at, and we're looking at a smaller diameter Earth, then this ocean closes up, and therefore there's no problem because all the two sides were actually joined at that time.
Yeah, and when you say reconstructed, just so people understand what we're talking about here, you can see, if you look at a map of the world today, how it appears that some of the continents can be slotted together. They appear to, you know, like sort of like a jigsaw. But when you do that on the Earth, as we're saying, the size it is now, it all doesn't kind of quite fit. But if you go on to, as our previous guest, James Maxlow, on his website, and there's other people who have done these reconstructions, if you reduce the diameter of the Earth, you can actually bring all the continents together, and it fits really, really neatly.
That's right, yes. Yeah, it fits together so neatly. I think James is saying that he's happy that he's got, I don't know, did he quote that it's 99% fit?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it's extreme, uncanny.
I think he's saying that you know, he's happy that he's got such a close fit that he just can't see that there's any way that how do you explain such a close fit? You know, to me it's as if somebody, if you imagine someone takes a plate, drops it on the floor, and then got all the broken bits, and then you take the plate and throw a third of the bits away, and someone then, you know, reconstructs it, it wouldn't fit together as a smaller plate, unless it really was a smaller plate. It's that same type of argument, I think.
Yeah, you can take the bits of the plate and you can put some of them together and they fit neatly, but you're going to be left with this, it's not quite satisfactory, it doesn't quite work.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work. Whereas if you look at the reconstructions that have been done, and James isn't the only one that's been, I mean, I've had a go myself just to reassure myself that what other people are saying is actually true, that you can actually put them all together, and in fact, if you doubt it, that's the way to go, to actually try and do it yourself, and just check what James is saying is actually true, that you can actually reconstruct them all together. So it's just uncanny, I think.
Well, I suppose for our purposes, it would be to break a plate and then try and make a bigger plate out of it.
Yes. Yeah, obviously, if you made a bigger plate, you'd have to somehow leave a gap there and then say, oh, well I must have lost all those bits somewhere then. Which would be the ocean floor that is assumed to have existed, but nobody can find any evidence of it.
I've recommended at the top of this, actually, that people listen to last week's interview before listening to this, because, you know, bits of this are going to, you know, be puzzling otherwise, if you take the conventional background to the development of the Earth. Again, as we move towards time of the appearance of the dinosaurs, and we've been through, as they talked about, microbial life and then life moving out of the shallow seas, reptiles, talking about the gravitational effects in life that was developing at this point, you began to see forms of life that were, compared to anything that's alive today, very, very large. And it's not just dinosaurs which came later. I mean, we're talking about plants that were huge, insects, later, you know, all forms of sea creatures we've talked about. And later on, of course, when the dinosaurs were around, birds. It's fascinating to look at some of these species, and none of these could exist in that form today.
Yeah, I mean, the largest dinosaurs were the sauropods, of course, and they were actually gigantic. They were the four-legged ones with long necks. Quite often the largest of them were about 10 times the mass of the largest living animal, our African elephant. And many of these sauropods measured from 20 to 25 metres long and stood 10 to 15 metres tall. And they're estimated to had a mass somewhere in the region of 80 to 100 tonnes. So they are actually gigantic beasts.
In your research, do mainstream scientists address issues to do with dinosaurs' fitness for purpose in terms of their size and their internal organs and all the rest of it and their mobility? Is it just assumed that, oh, well, that there was no problem there? Or have you read anybody looking at this and saying, oh, do you know there might have been problems with this?
It's a well-known problem that one of the main areas I look at is the strength of dinosaur leg bones. And this has caused a problem, well, for quite a few years. If we look at a leg bone of any animal, it's basically the strength of it is how thick the leg bone is. And In 1985, a team of scientists, Anderson and his colleagues, looked at all the bones from various sets of animals. And from this, they were then measured the circumference of the bones. And from this, they would actually compare that to the weight of the animal. And they actually produced a formula so they could actually work out how heavy an animal should be just from the bone circumference. And obviously, one of the things they were going to look at, they were going to look at dinosaur bones with this and then say, oh, OK, we can just easily measure the diameter of a dinosaur bone now and we can tell you how much it weighed. Unfortunately, when they did that, they realized that the actual weight that these calculations were giving was much less than the estimates from the models, the dinosaurs. And I mean, the other way of getting the mass of a dinosaur is just to make a model of it and then find out how much water it displaced, multiply it by the density, and then that gives you the weight. But the problem was that these leg bones were much too weak to actually support the weight they were seeing. And so, for instance, if we look at the Berlin Brachiosaurus, that was calculated as 46.6 tonne in 1985 by Professor McNeil Alexander, just using a model from the Natural History Museum. And yet the weight calculated from the bone dimensions was only 31.6 tonne. So if we actually look at what the weight is compared to the mass, that tells us that the paleogravity was actually 68% of our present gravity. That gives quite a problem. And how that's resolved, paleontologists have realized that dinosaurs somehow must have been weighed a lot less. So the sort of things they've looked at is that perhaps there were large pneumatic airbags throughout the body of the dinosaur actually reducing the weight. And so they actually managed to knock about 20% or so off the weight estimates. And then another way was to, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but dinosaurs used to look a lot chunkier than they do now. And so over the years, what's been happening is that they've made dinosaurs look a lot less heavily built.
Do you mean in illustrations and things?
In illustrations, yes. If you look at dinosaurs now, they look a lot thinner, don't they? A lot more athletic than they used to look. This also has been they've still been able to reduce a bit more of the weight off. But even when they've all done all that, you know, I mean, there was a team of German paleontologists, and they actually shrink wrapped the Berlin. It's actually been renamed now the Giraffe Titan, the Berlin Brachiosaurus, but, you know, just to confuse everybody, but it's actually been renamed now. And the German paleontologists actually shrink wrapped this animal to get it the skinniest possible they could, so that they were able to knock another 20% off their mass estimate. But even when you still do all this and you assume that they're effectively hollow by having large airbags in and they're really skinny, there's still a problem. You know, they're still finding that the bones aren't strong enough to support the weight of the animal that they're actually calculating by other means. So it is quite a problem in this field, yes.
And of course, assumptions that were made about dinosaurs for a long time led to the conclusion, amongst other things, that in general, the larger ones would have been very immobile, very clumsy, and only the smaller ones would have been darting about the place.
Yes, again, I mean, this, you know, this was quite an old idea, again, of everybody was wondering how could these animals possibly be so big. I mean, one suggestion was that they couldn't really move very quickly. I mean, if you imagine an elephant actually can't run. It can't actually leap up into the air because of its large size. So they extrapolated that and said, well, dinosaurs must have been virtually immobile, and that they, you know, they couldn't move anywhere then because of their large size. And so again, this is one of the problems, that you have to imagine dinosaurs being highly really very so unathletic. Dinosaurs like T-Rex, for instance, you constantly see articles saying that there's been various calculations done proving that Tyrannosaurus Rex couldn't run, therefore it couldn't hunt. And yet, if you look at a T-Rex, you'll see that it's got quite athletic-looking legs, and then there'll be reconstructions of it shown running after the animal hunting its prey, as you might have expected. So again, there's this problem of large. It's such a large animal that in theory it shouldn't be able to run, and yet everyone's looking at it and saying, well, I think it could run.
Well, so, it looks built to run, if you ask me, with those legs.
It does. It looks built to run. So this is the argument. But if you actually sit down and do the calculations of, are the leg bones strong enough? Are the muscles strong enough to enable it to run? Did they actually come across and they find, actually it wasn't. But it's only because we're assuming that it was still in our present gravity and it was trying to run in our gravity. If it ran in gravity that's half to today's value, it then would be able to run.
Well, you think of the astronauts who train in zero gravity or reduced gravity, what they're able to do that's absolutely impossible for us when we're just, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at them on the moon, jumping around on the moon, and they're hopping about on the moon, aren't they? Even though they've got quite a heavy backpack on, this is the same idea that you'd be able to leap around.
Flight, in terms of mobility, flight is another big issue here. If we think of the pterosaurs, those are things that when you look at them, the sheer size and the fact that these are gliders, that's another species of creatures that look entirely unfit for anything, really. Just can't imagine how they could move around, how they could be successful at all in our own gravity as things are. But you change the gravity, then they suddenly become viable.
That's right. One of the largest pterosaurs, it had a wingspan of something in the region of 10 to 13 metres, which is larger than some private aircraft. And so, once again, when we try and actually do the calculations on such a large animal, it's effectively reached its limit of size. It should have reached its limit of size a lot smaller than it had if it was in our present gravity. And as you say, you know, if we reduce the gravity, that allows the size of these animals to become larger.
How would gravity affect, I mentioned earlier about, you know, the huge scale of plants, sea creatures, birds, and insects, again, which you speak about in the book, how would gravity affect those as such? Which is exactly the same mechanism, because you're thinking, well, the birds and insects and sea creatures are mobile, you know, the plants are not. But is it just the same simple mechanism that applies?
Yes. I mean, I've tried to put it in a simple sentence in my book. And so I've said for a particular form of life, the linear scale of land-based life is inversely proportional to the strength of gravity. So effectively what I'm saying is that as gravity becomes less, life should proportionally be able to get bigger. And so the scale of all life should be affected. So we should actually see, we should not just larger dinosaurs, as you say, but plant life and insects. And I've looked at some of the insects as well. I mean, dragonflies are of particular interest. They've been around since well before the dinosaurs, since about 300 million years ago. Some of the largest, they're about just under a metre in wingspan, I think. Just using my simple idea that all, and again, I go into this a lot more detail in my book of how I've arrived at this particular formula. Again, you can actually calculate just by comparing the largest size of dragonfly in the past with the largest size of dragonfly today. So that gives you a rough estimate of what gravity was in the past. So about 300 million years ago, it's around about a third of present gravity.
Yeah, dragonflies are useful in that respect because there's not that many species that have, in some form, have survived all that time. You know, we've still got turtles, for example. They're one of the oldest. Mm. Millipedes is another one that you mention
yes.
In the book. In fact, there's that... Mm. that reconstruction that someone did of an ancient giant millipede, which is like something out of a horror film. I mean, it's it's colossal.
Yeah, I've actually got two photos in there, haven't I? I've got one of the a reconstruction of the dragonfly, and one of the millipede, which are actually done by the same chap. And he actually tells me that he's put those in. They're actually in a museum in Germany at the moment. But I thought those particulars were particularly good because they give a good, very good impression of how large these animals were. Because you actually see him alongside them, don't you? So very impressive, isn't it? The size of them.
He's losing the battle for space with the millipede in that. What are your thoughts about in terms of evolution? We have, some people speculate that we do have descendants of the dinosaurs still with us in the form of birds, but it's interesting to me how the dragonfly was able to kind of shrink over time, and we still can go down to riverbank on a summer's day and see them, but we don't have any little miniature T-Rexes running around.
Well, quite a few ancient life are still around, isn't it? That, as you say, the millipedes and the dragonflies are still around with us. I mean, it's fairly obvious that we wouldn't have the large animals because, of course, they couldn't survive in our gravity. But it's interesting that some of the smaller ones, you know, we don't see some of those actually surviving.
Well, I suppose, you know, it's the vagaries of evolution, because we're also told that there's so many more species of creatures that have existed that we've just never known anything about because the fossil record's very incomplete. So there's probably thousands, maybe even millions of species that existed on this planet that we'll never, ever have any clue about.
Yeah, if we went back in time, we'd probably be very surprised what we actually did see wandering around, I think. Although, having said that, I mean, we do have a fairly good idea that the ones we've got must have been representative, perhaps, of what the others that we don't know about look like.
Also, when you look at when the dinosaurs died out gradually, that was over a very long period of time. And that also fits with the expanding Earth theory. Now, whether there was a big asteroid strike or not, it doesn't actually, the fact remains that dinosaurs didn't die out overnight. So again, you know, it does fit with the expanding Earth theory.
I think one of the interesting things I've found, that perhaps it's not generally that well known, is that, I mean, the dinosaurs were the largest animals, but about 10, 20 million years after the dinosaurs, a range of supergiant mammals arose. They approached the size of the smaller dinosaurs, and then in their turn, they died out, and we've got quite recent giant animals that were around only 10 million years ago, and now they've died out, and so we're left with what we've got now is a very small sized range of mammals, but there were actually giant mammals and super giant mammals which were actually larger in the past.
That whole phase of evolution, I think, gets a bit overlooked. You know, when people are reading popular science books, it tends to go from dinosaurs, they died out, small mammals, then man. But there was all these millions and millions of years, as you say, of these supergiant mammals. And if people haven't looked at that phase, they should. A whole range of fascinating creatures, a lot of which are somewhat reminiscent of rhinoceroses, hippopotamus, horses, different things like that, pigs. But not exactly the same, but you can see similarities. And some of these things, you say, were approaching the size of small dinosaurs. And then, as the scale of life gradually reduced, that actually overlapped with the arrival of man as we know him. And there were, in the early days of man, there were some of these huge creatures, you say, that are no longer with us, but they did coexist. You know, for example, we think of just even the mammoth and saber-toothed cat, the cave bears, things like that.
Yes, that's right. They were all very large animals compared to modern day animals, but they're actually quite small compared to what had gone previously.
I've often wondered if, as things, conditions were different, and I thought about this in the context of the expanding Earth theory, as to whether there was anything in all of that that could have led to some of the myths that exist in human history, you know, of giant men and the story of Atlantis, you know, when it was an ice-free continent, and tales of fire from the sky and apocalypse and all the rest of it, whether some of it is based in fact when conditions in the world were different.
There must have been tales of gigantic animals, mustn't there, in the past, and perhaps they've people have exaggerated slightly, and you know, there's been tales of them, and also it, I mean, it's quite interesting that when people were going around, they were finding dinosaur bones before people realized that they were actually dinosaur bones, and they were looking at these and saying, look at that, there's been gigantic animals in the past. And of course, at that time, they used to think that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. So therefore, if they found any large bones, then the animals had to have existed quite recently. They didn't realise that these were actually from hundreds of millions of years in the past. So yeah, and that's all built up as myth, I think, of gigantic people in the past, yes.
And we talked earlier about new matter being added to the Earth, one of the ideas being that it's accruing from the rest of the solar system. Indeed, that's how all the planets were initially formed. You know, material starts to come together, sticks together, and it gradually begins to build up its own gravitational field, and it pulls more stuff in and so on. There were certainly periods throughout Earth's history when this would have been quite chaotic and violent. It wasn't just a matter of some dust gently coagulating. There were times it would have been, you know, bombardments of material from space. And if we're thinking about this wider theory, then we're assuming that the Earth is still expanding. And of course, there's, you know, some detail in your book about how that could be ongoing now. But it's possible that we're simply in a quiet period of the creation of this this new matter, and it may actually be that you know, that this becomes more violent again at some point in the future.
That's right. I mean, I've postulated that we've always had ice ages. So I've wondered in my book whether ice ages were actually connected to these dark nebulae of clouds of cosmic dust actually sweeping past the Earth and perhaps blotting the sun out for a short time and causing an ice age, and also putting a new layer of cosmic dust down onto the Earth. So I've taken that, you know, as far as I can with trying to see if we could see any correlation between the two. But that's as far as we can go, I think, at this time.
I think there's a statistic in your book that talks about, you know, because there's been a lot of talk recently about the that comet that they've put the little lander down on. And people are going, oh, my God. You know, some people have done graphics online showing how big it is compared to Los Angeles and London and all the rest of it, the implication being sort of you're being invited to speculate about what it might be like if that struck the Earth. But I think the statistic I was referring to is it something like 1,000 comets a day or something the size of a house entering Earth's atmosphere? But because they're basically ice and dust, they disintegrate. But that puts in perspective, you know, just how much material could actually be arriving here from space.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about, I think, the work of Frank, aren't you? Which, I mean, Frank and his colleagues in America have done some very interesting stuff. And they've actually been looking at the outer atmosphere, I think, of the Earth. And they've noticed that on their recordings from the satellites, they've noticed little blips forming every now and then. And they were just wondering what they were. And then, as they went through and tried to ascertain what this might be, the only thing they were left with was that the Earth was being constantly bombarded by some form of icy comets hitting the Earth. And they come up with some really amazingly high figures of how much material are actually hitting the Earth, I think, as you say it. But he's actually done his own book, and I think I mentioned in my book and given the reference of what that is. But you can actually look, and he's actually put some of the papers that he's written about it. He's put some of those on the internet as well, so you can actually have a look at those for yourself as well. But yeah, it's quite interesting because he's saying that actually the amount of material being added is significantly higher than what everybody thinks it is. So that was where I was coming from, you know, that actually it's quite high at the moment, even though we think it's quite low. It's just that we're not noticing it.
Yeah, and the question then would be, well, of the matter on Earth, does any of it ever actually sort of disappear and evaporate, or does it just get recycled? You know, in which case the volume is increasing.
Yeah, if all that cosmic material is being added to the Earth at this time, then the Earth must get bigger. There's no other way around it, I don't think.
In the second half of your book, you look at some of the other planets in the solar system. And one of the most intriguing things for me was, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, but it was a very early development in the Earth. Was it stromatolite? Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Will you talk about this form existing in the very early Earth, the possibility that particularly on the dark side of the moon, but also on unexplored regions of Mars, which is like, you know, 99.99% of it, that this stromatolite form could exist, and that then would be a very strong indication of life there, past or potentially future.
That's right. These things actually, they're actually mats of microbiological life that form into these mounds. And there are actually some still over in, you can actually look at them in Shark Bay over in Australia. They actually still exist. And we've actually found those right back, I think it's going back something like 2,500 million years. We've actually found those. So I've actually postulated that if the concept of the expanding Earth is correct, and the Earth was a lot smaller, then these stromatolites must have existed on a much smaller Earth. Therefore, we should be able to find them on the Moon and also on Mars. And Mars in particular is quite interesting, because I don't know if you've noticed at the moment, but there's been quite a bit of discussion about methane.
Yeah, that's in the news this week, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean that's been released, and so this idea that that type of life would actually exist on Mars at the present time would mean that we would find this methane being released as it's breaking down various and basically living its waste product from that form of life. You know, that's quite interesting that I've postulated that it should exist on Mars, and it'll be quite interesting if we ever get back to the moon to actually have a look round on the moon, and we should actually find it on the moon as well, possibly up on the polar regions where there might be a little bit of ice, and it should actually live under the ground.
The point being actually that these forms can exist in extreme conditions. And you mentioned in the book actually that there's forms of life on the Earth that exist in highly toxic, incredibly hot, incredibly cold environments that are completely, they sound like some of the descriptions that people talk about when they talk about other planets in the solar system. You just think, oh, that's insane. Nothing could live there.
That's right. Yes. It's just so extreme, isn't it? I think it does it go up to about 60 degrees C or something like that? It's virtually boiling anyway.
80, I think.
80. Yeah. I think it's virtually boiling water that, and life can still exist there. And then you can go right down to freezing and life can still exist in freezing temperatures.
Well, you had some lichens that were actually able to freeze completely and then quote unquote come back to life when things warmed up.
That's right, yes. Which is presumably what we're actually seeing on Mars. We're actually seeing life coming back to life as perhaps things warm up and just get to the right temperature. They start coming back to life, producing methane as a waste product, and then as things cool down, or they'll actually go back to sleep again and you know, just sit there and wait for the next burst of next warm phase to come.
The implication here being that in terms of the potential for expanding Earth theory to also apply to some other planets, or particularly all of them, actually, logically, that life on Mars, you know, we like to talk about, or people speculate about the potential of there was life on Mars at one point in a distant past, and then it became this harsh environment. We could actually be seeing the very early stages of life on Mars and perhaps other places as well. So if there was any form of life that we would recognize, it could be in the future in Mars. And you've talked actually about some evidence for, you know, circumstantial evidence looking at Mars that it might actually be undergoing some of the same stresses and strains. The cracks, for example, which other people have talked about as, you know, riverbeds or whatever from the past.
basically, the idea of the expanding Earth was that there was a continental shell that enclosed the whole smaller Earth. And as the Earth got bigger, cracks began to form, and this separated out the continents. All the continents now are the remnants of this continental shell that once enclosed the whole smaller diameter Earth. And Mars is round about the size of this smaller diameter Earth. So if we look at Mars, we should actually see some of the cracks beginning to form. And I've explained in my book, and I think I put a picture in there of a gigantic crack that is forming on just exactly as we would imagine it if Mars is just beginning this process of expansion. So it started to expand, and it's cracked the continental shell in one point, and over hundreds of millions of years, it will now continue to grow larger.
If we think about, people are often speculating about life on Earth and how it originated and what have you. In what, looking at some of the speculation that we've just been indulging in about the potential for life on Moon or Mars, that kind of, in my mind anyway, lends some credence to the idea that life on Earth could ultimately have come from somewhere else. Not so much the panspermia idea, but just that it's possible that somewhere in the cosmic debris was something that gave life at start. You know, perhaps, yeah, material on Earth, conditions on Earth that were also, that played a part, but that opens the way, as lots of people have wondered, you know, that logically there should be life elsewhere, if not in the solar system, then certainly elsewhere in the galaxy.
You're right. It has the whole idea of life existing on Mars has implications for life everywhere throughout the galaxy, because if life can exist in two places on our little solar system, then we must therefore assume that life can exist all over the place. If we had looked at Mars and if we decided that Mars didn't have any life and the Earth was totally unique, then perhaps we could imagine that there was no life elsewhere. But once we start spotting life on Mars and, you know, there's a few other places that I think, is it Titan that they're thinking it might actually exist? So once we start seeing that, we realise that life must be existing throughout the whole of the universe. Yeah, so it's quite a profound implications, I think, of what we're seeing, yes.
In terms of the mainstream reaction to these ideas, you know, in particular the expanding Earth theory and everything that we've been talking about that flows from that, the controversy for me is in the reaction that takes an anthropocentric position that's bordering on the religious, that we are it, basically. We have had paradigm shifts in science that have taken us forward, but I think in many ways that science, for very human reasons, for, you know, very egotistical reasons, denying the, even to speculate about some of these things, that we can be in danger of falling backwards, really, in terms of progress. And there's the old saying that you don't want to have your mind so open that your brain falls out. But, you know, it's a fine line. And I was led to think about recently when I watched the film Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and there was a future death cult of mutated humans who were worshipping nuclear warheads. They were scientists at one time, but they turned their science into a religion. I mean, what has your experience been since you started, because there's three editions of your book, so you've been at this for quite a while. What sort of reactions have you had, and what's your take on mainstream science's reaction to controversial ideas such as this?
Most people don't really like to think that the Earth could be expanding, because everybody tells us that the Earth has always been the same diameter. And as you say, it is virtually a religious dogma that the Earth has always been the same diameter over time. And I mean, you know, we've had quite a few professors of geology that have come along and said, well, there's a lot of evidence here, you know, that it's actually not been the same size. It has actually been expanding. And even they've not really managed to get past this wall of denial. People just want to believe that somehow the Earth was created at the size we see it, and it's not actually going to change in the future, and it's not changing now. you only have to look at, I think if you just look at, start looking at the evidence, the evidence is quite overwhelming, I think.
What is actually so controversial about it? If we collectively turned around tomorrow and said, okay, we've worked out the Earth was a lot smaller in the past, most people will go, oh, ho-hum, and go about their business. Is it just that it would be such a paradigm shift that it just would mean a lot of books being torn up and a lot of careers being changed? Is that what it all really boils down to?
Well, I think philosophers of history have looked at this, haven't they? And they have actually, they've virtually said that this is what happens, that people get in a position and they actually say, this is what's happened. And then when someone new comes along, and we've seen it throughout history, that someone new comes along with a new idea and says, well, actually, that's not what happened. Anybody who's staked their reputation on saying, oh, yes, I know all about the history, then they've really got quite a problem there. It's not a problem for the people who are coming along saying, I've looked at the evidence and this is what I think, because quite often it doesn't really matter to us because we're just saying what we see. It's the people who have to try and stop everybody else saying, oh, that's interesting, let's have a look at what you found, and trying to stop it.
Yeah, stop people just imagining, you know, as if there could be any danger in that, really, when people come down to, you know, when you really look at it. But it is just about perceptions and control, I think, really, of ideas. And
Yes, it's who controls the ideas. And as you say, there's been umpteen books about it, and it, quite often that is something that people will actually say. They'll say, if this was right, we'd have to rewrite all the textbooks. Well, surely it would be better to rewrite them and get them right rather than keep using the same ones that people are saying, there's a problem with that, you know.
So, I know, but people are quite often want to get the story settled, don't they? They get tired after a while. I think certainly the members of the public can, if they think that they're going to have their perceptions revised, their worldview changed too much. It's like, oh, can you not just work out what's going on and we can get on with it?
That's right. Yeah. I think you have to be a particular type of individual to actually find it interesting to actually, I mean, scientists actually call it having a multiple working hypothesis, where you actually have a number of different ideas going at the same time, sort of bubbling away in a pot, if you like. And each time you have a little look at it and you think, oh, does that one fit better? No, we'll... I don't think it's any better than the one we've already got. We'll keep using the one we've got. But, you know, a good scientist should actually continue looking at all these different ideas and actually seeing if another idea actually fits better, all the evidence they've got. But it's a lot more difficult than actually just having one pot that you say, right, that's definitely it. I've got that right. No one's going to change that now. So that's a lot easier, I think.
Yes, it is. So, okay, Earth is expanding. What are your thoughts, speculations, however wild, about the far future? What might we see? Well, we probably won't live to see it, will we? But, you know, how might this play out?
If it's expanding, as I think quite a few people are now thinking, that it's expanding because of mass, obviously it will continue expanding. As it becomes larger, it will gradually the Earth will gradually transform into a larger planet like Jupiter or Saturn. And at that point, because gravity will be able now to keep the lighter elements, we'll actually start attracting hydrogen into the surface. So the atmosphere will actually begin to change into more hydrogen-dominated atmosphere. But of course, that's hundreds of millions of years in the future. So I think you're right. I don't think we'll be around to see it. So there's no worry at the moment.
No, I don't think attempting to live on Jupiter or Saturn would work out well for us. So if we look at it from that. Well, Stephen, today we've been talking about your book, Dinosaurs and the Expanding Earth. Tell folks about where they can get that, share details of your website and anything else you'd like to put out there.
The book's widely available. If you go onto the Amazon sites, you can see it there. It's in the UK Amazon site, the US Amazon site. So it's widely available there, and you can also see it in other bookshops. So it shouldn't have any problem. It's called Dinosaurs and the Expanding Earth. Come along to my website as well, which is dino and then with an X. So it's dinox.org. And if you come along there, you can. I've got various links. I've written a few papers. Which are available as well. I've just done one recently that was published in September, which was about the strength of feathers, which I was suggesting again that we could use this to estimate paleogravity. So again, that's there's links to that on my website, which you'll find under papers.
Excellent. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations for 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.